And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today's morning show interview was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2015. We are taking a look today at one of the truly towering figures of the 20th century, Winston Churchill, who of course was Prime Minister of Great Britain during those crucial years of the Second World War, and in so many ways looms large in the hearts of his countrymen, and indeed for people all around the world. I mean, Winston Churchill was as important a symbol as anyone or anything when it came to the Allied effort to fight back against Nazi Germany and our other enemies during the Second World War. Of course, Winston Churchill is an incredibly complex and compelling figure, even beyond what he accomplished in leading Britain through the Second World War. And his life was a long one and an eventful one. And although a number of important biographies have been written about him, there probably has not yet been a book written that examined in such close detail a very crucial early chapter in Winston Churchill's life, the period between 1895 and 1900, when young Winston Churchill, in his early to mid-20s, was serving as a foreign war correspondent in several different theaters. And it is in these years that Winston Churchill first seems to tap into his gift for using words. And it's also here that he begins to, for the first time in his life, really taste some great success. It manages to demonstrate some focus and determination. And it's also in these years that Winston Churchill sees for the first time the reality of war, sometimes a very brutal reality indeed. All of this is examined in such fascinating fashion by author Simon Reed. His book is called Winston Churchill Reporting, Adventures of a Young War Correspondent, and it is published by Da Capo Press. And I'm delighted to be able to have the next few minutes to speak with Simon Reed about his fascinating book. Simon Reed, we welcome you to the morning show.
Greg, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm very, very happy to be talking with you. Talk for a moment about the challenge of examining a much-examined life like that of Winston Churchill, someone about whom so many superb books have been written. You list more than a few in your acknowledgments. So a lot has been written about Churchill. What kind of a challenge does it represent to, in a sense, say something new, something revelatory about such a figure?
Right. Well, yeah, obviously no shortage of books on the guy. There are like thousands of biographies, it seems. But, Greg, when we think of Churchill, like you said, we tend to think of him as sort of Britain's iconic war leader. And I've always been fascinated by what kind of shaped him into this character that he became, this figure that, you know, still stands very large over history, as you said. And, you know, when you look at Churchill's life, you know, it's not short on accomplishment or adventure. And when you go back and you look at the very things he did, I think the most formative period of his life were the years, 1895 to 1900, he spent as this war correspondent, for several reasons. Like I said, introduced him to the complexities of war. It helped hone his command of the English language, introduced him to the pleasures of cigars and whiskey, which are obviously famous Churchill vices. You know, the challenge in writing a book about a guy like Churchill, who's been written about so much, I don't know if you're necessarily going to uncover facts that are, you know, wholly new, that are completely unknown. But I think when it comes to Churchill, his life is so complex and so multifaceted that I think you can approach it from various angles and you can present him perhaps in a light that many people might not be familiar with. You know, people who've read biographies on Churchill that have covered his life in its entirety are probably aware that Churchill worked as a war correspondent, but they might not be so familiar with sort of the details of the various adventures that he got involved in. So the challenge in writing Winston Churchill reporting was to try and present him in a new light. And sort of in this book, he's sort of like the man of action. Right? He's a young adventurer. Experiences that he had on these foreign battlefields were both horrific, but also incredibly exciting. And when I was writing the book, Indiana Jones kept coming to mind, which might sound strange, but it is. It's almost Winston Churchill in an Indiana Jones mode. I mean, he took active part in combat. He was in cavalry charges. He was throwing himself into the front line. He was not afraid under enemy fire. And so I think hopefully, even if people have read a lot of Churchill biographies, hoping if they read Winston Churchill reporting, they'll come away seeing Churchill in a way that they've never really seen him before or think about him in a way they've never thought about him before.
Explain what you meant when you say at one point that you didn't write this as a biography or even as a work of history, even though as we read it, I mean, it clearly has elements of both of those things. I mean, and this is not a bit of frippery. I mean, this is a thoroughly researched book and beautifully written. But obviously, there were some intentions in your mind as you wrote it that you did not want it to align easily or neatly with, for instance, previous biographies or works of history. What were you after? What would you call this if not a biography or a work of history?
You're right. I don't sort of consider it either. Although, like you said, it does have elements of both. And obviously, the book it's a work of nonfiction. It's all true. But to me, it's I describe it as a nonfiction action adventure story. I've always loved true adventure stories. Into Thin Air by John Krakauer, Martin Dugard's Into Africa. Sort of stories of people, riding this incredible precipice of like danger and excitement. And I was always looking for a nonfiction story that I could write about in that vein. And I've always been fascinated by Churchill. And I'd finished reading a Churchill biography a couple of years back, and had read about his the chapter. I sort of glossed over his experiences as a war correspondent. As a former reporter myself, that kind of fascinated me, and so I started doing a bit more research. And I discovered that he wasn't just going off to these foreign battlefields and reporting; he was throwing himself into the action. And I just thought this is a great action adventure story that hasn't really been written about in sort of great detail. There's never really been a deep dive on it. And the more I researched it, the more I found that it really was an action-packed story. And so, when you read a biography is like sort of like a chronological detailing of specific events and sort of analysis and whatnot. And I didn't necessarily want it to be I didn't want it to come across as too academic, the book. I wrote it basically in mind of it being a page turner. To me, this is a book you could, if it came out in the summer, you could take it to the beach and read it on the beach. I wanted it to sort of move along with kind of the velocity of a bullet. So it's very quick. Yeah.
And you're fortunate that you're writing about events that move as fast as a bullet. I mean, you don't really have to do much contrivance to create a book along those lines. I mean, you chose exactly the right subject matter, exactly the right story in which such a book would emerge.
Exactly, yeah. The sort of campaigns that he was involved in were so, they were brutal, they were pretty horrific, they were not short on action. The book, it was actually, in a way, it was a very easy book to write because the story tells itself so well. And it's, of all the books I've written, this is the most fun I've had ever writing one because the material is just so rich and it's so entertaining. And hopefully that does come across when people read it. But the main intent was to, write sort of a work of history, but one that's also like a real sort of barnstormer.
Right. Before we dig into some details, could you just say a word about the process of researching this book and uncovering maybe at least a bit of information that hasn't been available in quite such fine detail as it is in this book. What were sort of the most valuable resources to which you turned in order to tell this story as richly as you do?
There are two sort of resources that proved most valuable in writing the book. First and foremost are the articles he wrote for the various papers. He wrote for the Daily Graphic, which is obviously no longer around. That was a newspaper in London. He wrote for the Telegraph, which is obviously still around and doing well. And he wrote for the Morning Post, which is now a defunct publication. And so those articles themselves were employed to a great extent in the writing of the book. And those were retrieved from the Churchill Archives in Cambridge and also the British Newspaper Archive in the UK. And those provide amazing detail on the places and cultures that he experienced and also sort of the combat that he saw. And then also his personal letters home also were used a lot. And they're interesting because you see another side of Churchill. You obviously see the side that he writes about in the newspaper articles, and then you see him voice his opinion about things in letters home to his mother. And I should say that when you look at some of the experiences he goes through in this book, you would think most men would write home, say, "My God, this is awful, and you know, I'm scared to death out here." He really enjoyed the adrenaline and the rush of it. And these letters home are very fascinating because you see a guy who he acknowledges sort of the horrors that he sees, but on the same token, he's kind of hooked on the adrenaline rush of being in combat. I think today we could even call him an adrenaline junkie. but it's definitely his own personal letters and the articles he wrote were the two primary sources of information for the book.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Simon Reed, and we are talking about his latest book. He has, I think, seven different books before this one. His latest is called Winston Churchill Reporting, Adventures of a Young War Correspondent. This book focuses on the years of 1895 to 1900, when a very young Winston Churchill, he turns 21, I think, fairly early in this period, finds himself in several different places, actually around the world, as a war correspondent. And in many respects, Simon Reed regards this as the most formative period of the young Churchill's life. One of the things I appreciate, Simon Reed, about your book is the time that you take to set the perspective. You don't go into relentless detail, but I think you give us just enough of an idea of Winston Churchill's childhood and what his parents were like to help us understand why Winston Churchill would be so hungry for the adventures that he experienced. Let's just talk about that for a moment. One of the things you say at one point is that his parents, for as distinguished as they were in some respects, left a lot to be desired as parents. How so?
Right. They were not sort of warm, loving parents. In fact, they were very distant, and that's not necessarily uncommon for the era in which Churchill was born. You know, most kids in that sort of social strata back in those days were left in the care of a nanny and shipped off to boarding school and whatnot. But Churchill's parents were exceptionally distant. They were social animals. His mother, Lady Randolph Churchill, was a hostess on the London party scene. And she was in much demand as a hostess and as a lover. She was a very beautiful woman back in the day. And his father, Lord Randolph Churchill, he was a rising star in the Conservative Party. And politics were his passion. And he didn't have much time for parenthood, and he certainly didn't have a lot of time for Churchill. And I think by today's standards, we could say that Lord Randolph was emotionally and verbally abusive as a parent. He'd say terrible things to Churchill and basically dismissed him his entire life as a failure. And so Churchill, strangely enough, adored his father and looked up to his father. His father was a political hero to Churchill, and Churchill really wanted to follow in his footsteps. But Lord Randolph dies in, I believe it's December 1894, just as Churchill is sort of going into the military. And, you know, Churchill is very upset that his father doesn't live to see him accomplish anything. And I think the relationship between Churchill and his father, it's a defining characteristic of Churchill's sort of entire life, because the father had these expectations that Winston never lived up to. You know, Churchill was kind of a screwball in school. He never took school very seriously, and it drove his father mad. But I think that Churchill sort of spent his entire life trying to live up to his father's failed expectations. You know, Churchill goes into politics because his father was a politician, and you know, Churchill goes off to these battlefields to try and make a name for himself in a way to sort of live up to what his father wanted him to become. And I think it's telling, Greg, you know, there's a story that Lady Mary Soames, Churchill's youngest daughter, told several years ago. She recounts a story where Churchill is near the end of his life, and she asks him, you know, father, you know, you've done so much with your life. Is there anything that you regret? And Churchill looked at her and apparently said, you know, I regret that my father never lived to see me do anything with my life. And I think that's pretty amazing that a man who can accomplish as much as Winston Churchill did can still have a regret at the end of his life that his father sort of considered him a failure. And I think that sort of is a, I think that's sort of a vital clue in sort of trying to understand Churchill's motivation and aggressiveness in life.
Right. Not that I want to defend for one moment Lord Randolph and the way, the really brutal way that he treated his young son. But in fact, you describe young Winston as, at least in some respects, a failure at some of what he attempted. I mean, when we think about the towering figure whom he eventually became, it's interesting to read, for instance, about what a poor student he was, of how it took three tries for him to gain admittance to the Royal Military College, that he was somebody who lacked focus, who lacked drive, and so on. There was at least some ostensible reason for Lord Randolph's frustration and displeasure with his young son, even if we end up being sort of horrified at the way that he acted on it.
It's true. I mean, Churchill was, by all accounts, a miserable student. You know, he did not pay attention in class. The thing with Churchill is, even Churchill has a reputation for being, you know, stubborn throughout his entire life. And basically, you know, with Churchill did what Churchill wanted to do. You know, if he didn't want to do it, he didn't show much interest. And you know, you sit there in school, you're having Latin jammed down your throat and mathematics and all this other stuff. None of that sort of ever really appealed to Churchill. It's interesting that as a student, the two areas that he excelled in are history and English. And those were his passions, but everything else he just thought was absolutely pointless. And so a lot of Lord Randolph's frustration and rage with Winston does stem from Churchill's miserable performance in school. What's interesting, though, is although he's a terrible student, there are teachers who write letters home to his parents saying, look, your son's a total screw-up in class, but he has amazing potential if he can just sit there and apply himself. So people did recognize that there's this sort of underlying, you know, genius or whatever you want to call it there in the child. It was just trying to actually access it and get the boy to apply himself.
Right. One of the things I especially appreciate about this early portion of the book is the detail with which you describe young Winston's love of toy soldiers. And I think for a lot of us, if the only time we've ever played with toy soldiers is just the little green plastic things, right. We don't really have much of a sense of what it meant 100 years ago to play with toy soldiers. And especially if somebody was in a fairly privileged household and could play with the very best toy soldiers, I mean, and have an enormous collection of them. I mean, you could really do some amazing things. At one point you write, Winston's military campaigns waged in miniature stimulated a powerful and imaginative mind. Just say a quick word about what you are describing here and the way in which it sort of intriguingly points to what is to come.
Sure. Churchill, from a very early age, was fascinated by military matters. And, you know, he's born in the Victorian era where, you know, sort of war at that time is a romantic notion. It's, you know, two European armies meeting on an open battlefield beneath unfurling flags with cannons booming. And that was something that really appealed to Churchill. And so, and also his ancestor, you know, first Duke of Marlborough was a great British military hero, defeated the French in a series of battles in the early 18th century. And Churchill grew up around all of this. And the earliest surviving letter from Churchill was written when he was 7 years old, and it's a letter thanking his mother for some toy soldiers and a castle that he received for Christmas. And Churchill had, he amassed this huge collection of lead toy soldiers. Like he said, Greg, today we think of them as like these little plastic green guys. Back then, you know, they were much more ornate and detailed and, you know, colorful, and you know, they were made of lead. He built up a collection of 1,500 of them, which he would then arrange on the playroom in Blenheim Palace, where he spent a lot of his childhood. And he'd sort of waged these military campaigns. And his father came in one day. It was a rare moment of father-son bonding. It only lasted for a couple of minutes. But Lord Randolph comes into the playroom one day, and Churchill has all these soldiers arranged in various formations on the nursery floor. And sort of the way Churchill has organized this really impresses Lord Randolph. It's the first time he's ever seen his son really focus on something to this extent. And so Lord Randolph thinks to himself, oh, well, you know, maybe my son, he'll be a miserable student, but maybe he'll excel in military matters. And so Lord Randolph sort of decides, okay, maybe we need to push him into the army. And that's what sort of starts Churchill on the road to sort of a military life.
Hmm. And I will close this portion by saying that when he finally gains admittance to the school and writes a letter home, I mean, very, very proud of what has just happened, his father, you tell us, writes back a letter of blistering denouncement and accused his son of living an insignificant life. And yeah. And of course, it's so interesting to think about the fact that by the time the 20th century is over, it's hard to think of anyone whose life was more significant than Winston Churchill.
Exactly.
I mean... We're speaking with Simon Reed about his book, Winston Churchill Reporting, Adventures of a Young War Correspondent. So when we are talking about the mid-1890s and Winston Churchill has gained commission to join the 4th Hussars, it is actually a very quiet existence, nothing like what he had dreamt of. Just how quiet was it on the battlefront, so to speak, for Winston Churchill? I mean, it helps explain why he was so hungry to seek out adventure in other places.
Right. It's very quiet. You know, the British Empire at this point, you know, it covers about a quarter of the globe, and all is relatively quiet across the empire. You know, you have the various little skirmishes that might arise from sort of presiding over so much of the world's population. But there are no large military campaigns. You know, we're talking 1895 here. The last big European war was the Crimean War, which had been a couple of decades before. So there's not a whole lot going on. And the one thing Churchill loathed more than anything was boredom and inactivity. You know, he always had to be occupied doing something. And being in the army, he had expected to sort of go off and have some adventures, but that's not the case. He's sitting around in his barracks outside of London, sort of waiting for something to happen. And this is sort of the thing that kickstarts the war corresponding career, because while everything is peaceful with Britain's empire, the same can't be said for Spain. You know, Spain is a fading colonial power, And at this time, they're trying to put an end to a rebellion in Cuba, where Cubans have risen up against their some masters in Madrid. And Churchill reads accounts of this uprising in the London newspapers, and he decides, well, you know what? Nothing's going on around here. There's no prospect of me being sent anywhere. I wonder if I can go to Cuba and sort of check things out there for myself and just see how I do under enemy fire. You know, Churchill was always curious as to how he'd hold up under combat. And so, you know, he wanted to test his bravery. And so he saw Cuba as a good starting ground for this. And so he writes his mother a letter in October of 1895. And it says, like, "Dear Mama, this may come as a surprise to you, but I've decided to head off to a war zone in the West Indies." And his mother is very shocked by this, but she, you know, sort of goes along with it. And because Churchill is Churchill and his father was Lord Randolph and had all these political connections, Churchill is able to use family connections to make this happen. You know, family connections in the War Office, family connections in the Foreign Office. But, you know, with Churchill, it's not just a case of going off and having an adventure in Cuba. He's already thinking at this young age he wants to follow in his father's footsteps and have a political career. If you want to go into politics, though, you need a public profile. You need a platform you can stand on. And so Churchill sees this as an opportunity to perhaps start building his public persona. You know, what better way to distinguish yourself than by being brave in combat? And so he decides he's going to report on his experiences. And he ends up getting a contract, a commission, with the London Daily Graphic to file five columns from the Cuban battlefront. And so off he goes in early November 1895 to Cuba with a stop off in New York. And that's basically the start of what turns into sort of a five-year adventure on these various battlefields.
You write at one point, "Peace was not conducive to young Churchill's longing for adventure." And at another point, you write, I love this line, "Battle was a worthy alternative to boredom, which to Churchill was the greatest sin." And, of course, what ensues is anything but boring. Just say a word about the unlikeliness of this assignment. I mean, what kind of strings had to be pulled in order for this to be possible, for Churchill to be given this assignment?
Right. Quite a few strings had to be pulled. First, the War Office had to sign off on it because, you know, Britain had no involvement in the conflict in Cuba. It was strictly between Spain and you know, the Cubans. And so, first of all, permission had to be granted by the War Office, which was granted. And then permission had to be granted by the Foreign Office, by the ambassador to Spain. He gave his approval. And then there had to be strings pulled in Cuba. You know, the Cuban military had to sign off on letting a young British officer show up and, you know, report on the battles. And so diplomatic strings were pulled. And Cuba, you know, the Cuban officials said, sure, you know, he can come on over. The key player in all of this and getting all of this done wasn't Churchill himself. It was Churchill's mother, Lady Randolph. She was a woman, like we sort of alluded to earlier, she was a woman of very considerable charm, and she knew how to flatter men in positions of power. She had a lot of admirers, and this really sort of worked out to Churchill's benefit. And it's sort of interesting that when Churchill was a child, Lady Randolph was a very distant parent. But as Churchill got older, she became much more involved in his life. And it's because of her, really, that he's able to go off to a lot of these places that he goes off to as a war correspondent, because she's the one who sort of charms and cajoles people into letting Churchill have his way. And it's almost as if she was making up for the years of neglect from Churchill's childhood, but she really does become his biggest champion.
Hmm. You tell us that the journey across the sea was not exactly a pleasure crew. You say by the end, Churchill was ready to leap overboard. I'm glad you take a couple of pages to describe actually sort of the front end of this adventure, in which he first stops off in New York City, if I'm not mistaken.
He stops off in New York City. He's meant to be there for just a couple of days, but he ends up staying a week. And he's hosted by a local politician, Bert Cochran, who is a big early influence on Churchill's life. Cochran, he's sort of forgotten now, but he was a great orator, you know, fantastic public speaker. And he sort of treated Churchill like a son. It's rumored that Cochran and Churchill's mother had an affair at some point in the past, and Lady Randolph had written to Cochran saying, "Will you host Winston when he's in New York?" And Cochran had agreed to do it. And Cochran takes Churchill all around New York, introduces him to New York high society. He has dinner with the Vanderbilts. It's a very, it's a very elegant week spent in very elite company. And Churchill was amazed at New York. It sort of blew his mind. You know, London at the time was sort of the capital of the world, but New York just had this amazing energy to itself, and he was fascinated by Americans. He found them kind of crude and vulgar in a lot of ways, but he also found them to be a very positive and uplifting type of people. And it fascinated him. Like, public transport in New York fascinated him, where you could get on a boat or a carriage and you'd have the lower and upper classes sitting side by side, whereas in London there were very clear social class distinctions. You didn't see that. And so New York was a completely different world to him. The one thing that he could not stand about America was the currency. He thought paper money was absolutely awful. But he thought it was a very crude thing. And he paid he pays like a dollar or something to cross the Brooklyn Bridge. And he's embarrassed handing a paper note over to the toll taker. But that's really his only complaint. He also saw America. He viewed America on this first trip kind of as a brash young child who doesn't really have any table manners and no tradition. He goes at one point to a murder trial in New York, and he sits there in the courtroom, and he's amazed to see that none of the lawyers or judges sit there wearing long black gowns and powdered wigs like they do in the UK. And he just couldn't believe that this up and coming country could be so devoid of tradition. But there was something about America that he loved. His mother was American, so he's half American, so he had an affinity for the country already programmed into his DNA. But his adventures in New York, it gave rise to a lifelong love affair of the country.
Well, we are finally getting to the real heart and soul of the book, of course, which is this adventure finally beginning. And it is, as you were saying, an adventure that has several different chapters, beginning with this conflict in Cuba. Just remind our listeners about what that conflict was about. You've already mentioned the fact that it was not a conflict in which Britain was directly involved at all.
Right. Yeah, it was basically the Cuban War for Independence. Cubans had risen up against their colonial masters in Madrid. Cuba was a nation rich in natural resources, in sugar and in tobacco, Spain was placing very heavy taxes on Cuba, and basically taxing the Cuban nation to death. And Cubans had enough and sort of risen up in rebellion. And so Churchill had gone over there. He was embedded with Spanish troops. He'd gotten permission of Spanish authorities in Cuba, and so he was embedded with Spanish troops. And he was attached to a Spanish column, basically, that was working its way through the Cuban jungle, giving supplies to the garrisons in the various Cuban villages dotted across the island. And so this is his first foray sort of into combat, and this is where he comes under fire for the first time.
I believe it is during this conflict that he writes about a certain battle called the Battle of La Reforma. Am I remembering that right?
Yeah. And with the Cuban campaign, he didn't really see anything that rises above more than a skirmish. What he sees is mostly guerrilla warfare, which leaves a very bad taste in his mouth. The Cubans would dart out of the jungle, fire at the Spanish column Churchill was a part of, and then retreat back into the vegetation. To Churchill, that was a very cowardly way of fighting. But sort of the campaign culminates in this battle of Reforma, where sort of the Spanish troops Churchill's attached with finally come face to face with a Cuban army. And the battle doesn't last very long, and it's sort of anticlimactic in Churchill's point of view, and the Spanish win and force the Cubans back into the jungle. And then the Spanish don't even, you know, take off after them. They kind of mill around, and Churchill, we sort of see a hint of Churchill, the future war leader here. Churchill is just disgusted by this. He goes, you know, we've traipsed through the jungle for a week in the most horrendous conditions. We finally come face to face with the enemy. You defeat them, but you don't go after them to finish the job. And, you know, Churchill, when it came to military matters, was very aggressive.
Right.
And so the Battle of La Reforma is sort of the big climactic scene of his Cuban adventure, although it leaves a lot to be desired in his mind. And he leaves, you know, not thinking very highly of the Cuban soldiers, but also he leaves with some criticism of the way the Spaniards conduct the war, too.
This is one of the excerpts from his actual writing that I took the time to write down just because I thought it was an intriguing glimpse into the man he was going to become, as you say, but also an example of how already at this young age he writes very, very well. He writes at one point, this is Winston Churchill's words, "It seems a strange and unaccountable thing that a force, after making such vigorous marches, showing such energy in finding the enemy, and displaying such steadiness in attacking him, should deliberately sacrifice all that these efforts had gained." I mean, that sums it well. Yeah, right. I mean, it sums it up extraordinarily well. And you remind us that it's right around his 21st birthday that for the first time he has bullets whirling through the air. I mean, and suddenly war is not about toy soldiers anymore. War is very, very real, although it is not as dramatic as he will experience in some of the later chapters. But nevertheless,
exactly,
this is his first taste of the reality of war.
It is. It is. And he actually comes under enemy fire on the morning of his 21st birthday. He gets up and he mounts his horse, and as the Spanish column is moving out, Cuban rebels emerge from the undergrowth at the rear of the column and start firing. And they're several yards away from where Churchill is. You know, they're quite a ways down the line from Churchill's spot. But, you know, it's enough to sort of kind of give Churchill pause and realize that, oh my God, you know, I could actually get killed or injured here. And suddenly, like you said, it's not a game anymore. There's a real risk to it. But it sort of stokes his appetite for more.
Hmm.
That's what's interesting.
Some of these first columns, if I remember correctly, from Cuba are published, but without Churchill's name attached to them, which is very, very frustrating and offensive to him. And that's one of the reasons why he sets about to write a book, which ends up being well received, positively reviewed for the most part. And you tell us that never before had Churchill been praised in such fashion.
Right. He actually writes a book following his following a campaign he covers on the northwest frontier of British India, which is today sort of the border region between Afghanistan and Pakistan. And the fighting that he saw there was very fierce. British and Indian soldiers were in a campaign against the area's Pashtun tribesmen, which are the ancestors of today's Taliban. And just as, you know, the fighting in that region in modern times is fierce, so it was very fierce back then. And Churchill sees a lot of horrible things on that campaign. But when he finishes the campaign, he finds the articles that he's written in the Daily Telegraph have all been published anonymously, which drives him absolutely nuts because he's putting life and limb, you know, he's risking his life for publicity. And so what he decides to do is he decides to write a book. And he discovers that there's another guy writing the book about the same campaign at the exact same time. And so he really applies himself hard. He starts writing this book in October of 1897, and in just under 8 weeks, he writes an 85,000 word manuscript. And you know, Winston Churchill reporting that book's about 85,000-90,000 words. You know, that took me a year to write. So he really pushed himself to the breaking point.
You tell us never had he known such intense focus.
he never had. He was writing up to 8 hours a day, you know, sitting in his barracks in India, his hand cramping. He really, you know, it was a real accomplishment. And when the book does come out the following year, it receives, you know, very high praise. The critics all love it. He even receives praise from the British Prime Minister, Lord Salisbury at the time, who says it's wonderful. And it establishes Churchill as a rising literary star.
You do recount how Winston Churchill saw some terrible things during this period. And sometimes it was the horrific bloodshed of the battle itself. And on more than one occasion, he also witnessed barbaric behavior that really, in your words, left him deeply shaken, even though he was not a man easily shaken by much of anything. But he saw some truly terrible things, and this had to have a deep impact upon him. Just say a word about that.
It did. When he goes to the Northwest Frontier in 1897, Cuba is a light skirmish. The Northwest Frontier is really a savage battle. The fighting there was horrific, and he sees a lot. The tribesmen that the British and Indian troops are up against were incredibly fierce warriors, incredibly brave in combat. They were not timid at all, and they were just savage warriors. And so Churchill, in the fighting is very, you know, it's almost hand-to-hand. It's extremely brutal. Churchill sees men ripped apart with spears and swords. He sees a wounded Indian soldier subbed into an incinerator. He just sees things that really leave a mark. And he writes an interesting letter home to his mother that says, I've seen things that will stay with me forever. But he also says that he's still having an amazing time because of the adventure. And this is where you see sort of the complex view on war, Churchill's complex view on war take shape. He loved the complexity and scope of war, and he loved the adrenaline rush of combat, but he hated the human toll. He hated the blood cost of war, and it created a very sort of powerful divide in his personality. And so from that point on, he always has a loathing for ineptitude in the higher ranks. He can't stand generals who make decisions that cost needless lives, and that's something that sticks with him forever. And as a war correspondent, he does not shy away from criticizing generals in print who make stupid decisions. But it was, you know, people dismiss Churchill as a warmonger, you know, his critics tend to. But that wasn't the case, because he did, you know, there are times in the book where he stands crying over the graves of fallen soldiers. And so he's very much aware of war's human cost, and he's aware of that from a very early age.
Hmm. And it's interesting that he is not afraid to write frankly about his own government or about certain decisions of the military. I mean, if all of this had been a purely self-serving venture, he probably would have not spoken as frankly and honestly as he did in his writing.
Exactly. Greg, you nailed a really important point. Churchill is going off to these war zones to try and build a public platform for himself through journalism. But Churchill was a guy of great sort of moral courage. He never said anything to gain popularity. He never said anything for his own political advancement. He only said what he believed to be right. Even if it was wrong and it proved unpopular, he still stuck by it. We certainly see that during the 1930s when he's, you know, speaking out against appeasement and trying to warn the British public about the rise of Nazi Germany. You know, that cost him hugely in terms of his political career to begin with. But we also see that as a young man, where he puts into print, you know, these scathing indictments of generals who make foolish decisions. You know, he many times he criticizes the government that he wants to be a part of. And so Churchill was a man of his word. He was a man of very strong beliefs. He said what he meant, and he meant what he said. And, you know, that was the case pretty much through his entire life. But we definitely see it emerge, when he is on these foreign battlefields.
Hmm. I think we made brief mention of it earlier, but we should just for a second talk about the fact that during one of these campaigns, I believe it's when he's in South Africa, he is captured And he is imprisoned for a good month before he manages to escape, and then has a whole series of adventures as a fugitive. This makes for some of the most engrossing stuff in your book.
Yeah, he is. He goes off to South Africa to cover the Second Boer War, which is a war between Britain and sort of Dutch settlers on the Cape. And the war was fought primarily over access to gold and other resources in the region. It was a brutal war. It started in 1899. It can almost be seen as a prologue to sort of the bloodshed and carnage of the Western Front in World War One. The British are up against a modern enemy with modern weapons, and it's a bloody affair. But Churchill, he's taken prisoner. He goes there as a correspondent for the Morning Post. He's on an armored train that's reconnoitering some enemy territory, and the train is shelled by the enemy, and it's derailed. And there's a lot of chaos when the train is derailed. Churchill comes under a heavy fire, but he helps get the train back on the track. This is borne out in testimony from numerous witnesses. He helps get the train back on the track and helps a lot of men get away. But Churchill himself is taken prisoner, and he's held for quite a while in Pretoria, in South Africa. And he finally, one night, escapes by climbing over a wall. And he now has this hundreds of miles march through enemy territory to try and get back to the British lines. And he does this by traveling at night, hopping aboard trains, sleeping in railway carriages. He finally comes to a mine, a mining operation that's run by a British guy who takes Churchill in. And Churchill lives for 3 days underground in a mine, being, scurried over by rats and everything else. It's an awful experience. And then he smuggles into neutral territory aboard a train. And then from there he makes his way back to the British lines to rejoin the fight. But it was that adventure, because while he's on the run, he's still writing articles about it. he's detailing his escape as it's happening. He leaves out some details because he doesn't want people to get he doesn't want retribution against the people who've helped him. But when he finally returns to British lines, he's hailed as a hero. And when his articles are published back in the UK, he becomes a national hero back home. And that's when we see Winston Churchill, the young war correspondent, suddenly become Winston Churchill, a national figure.
And of course, in 1900, he enters Parliament, and history begins to be made. At one point in your book, you say what forces, you pose this question, what forces shaped him into the man he became? He was, after all, 65 years old when he ascended to number 10 Downing Street, with a life behind him not short on accomplishment. And of course, your book helps us understand this very, very crucial period early in the life of Winston Churchill, which helped equip him to be the world-shaking figure that he was. The book, again, is called Winston Churchill Reporting, Adventures of a Young War Correspondent, published by Da Capo Press. Simon Reed, congratulations on a superb book, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. This has been a real pleasure.
Greg, it's been fantastic. Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we're going to be finding out all that is offered at one of the loveliest places in all of southeastern Wisconsin, Hawthorne Hollow, located right on Green Bay Road, close to the line between Kenosha and Racine counties, a beautiful haven. We're going to be enjoying Fernand Calvert's May visit to The Morning Show, conversation with Executive Director T.J. Lebeck, and naturalist Kaylin Dahl. Friday on The Morning Show, an interview out of the archives that I enjoy replaying around Mother's Day. It's an interview with Lori Leibovich, the author and editor of a really intriguing book called Maybe Baby. 28 writers tell the truth about skepticism, infertility, baby lust, childlessness, ambivalence, and how they made the biggest decision of their lives. And of course, that decision was whether or not to be mothers, whether or not to have children. It's a wonderfully written book, absolutely essential reading, in my opinion. We'll hear that interview on Friday. And on Monday, Martin McClendon and two theaters.